We discovered the place, the Swedish nudists and I. They all went round in the buff and got themselves tattooed. What shall I get him to do? I asked Benny. Björn and Benny were also there, you see. We'd all recognized them and knew they were world stars, of course, but nobody made a hoo-ha about it because we were all the same on the beach at Pattaya. That's because we were all naked, with free love and all the trimmings, naturally. Benny used to send me an occasional postcard later on, but the phoenix idea was my own. I realized early on it was my symbol, my totem, you know. Life is change, I told Benny, so you have to keep reinventing yourself. You may come a cropper or even get burnt, but you simply have to rise from the ashes. Because, as I told Benny, it's a question of the winner taking it all. Poldy assumed the expression she always wore when immersing herself in sentimental memories. The winner takes it all, she repeated. Benny liked that. He knew exactly what a phoenix is.
My aunt also knew a thing or two about phoenixes, and rising from the ashes. Poldy obviously realized that the dead cat outside her door was intended as a warning to drop the Valentino case once and for all. Possibly even to quit Torre Akirafi or Sicily, though she wasn't willing as yet to credit the cat killer with so extreme a demand. His message was unmistakable, whichever way one looked at it. The Via Baronessa was quieter than usual that morning. No moped was blatting, no radio blaring, no one could be seen or heard. It was as if the death of the little creature had expunged all signs of life from the street. Poldy bent down and carefully picked up the animal. A young tortoiseshell tom with a half-chewed ear. Very thin and stiff as a washboard, it was only an ownerless stray, but to Poldy that was irrelevant. Someone had snuffed out a life in order to threaten her. Had possibly lured the hungry creature with a morsel of fish, and then cold-bloodedly slit its throat just like that. Whoever had done this had no respect for life, no concern for creation, and in Poldy's view, he himself deserved no respect or concern for that reason. Whoever it was that had killed the tortoiseshell Tom, she hoped he would rot in hell, swore to find him and call him to account. But first she buried the cat. Having wrapped the animal in an old pillowcase, she took a spade and drove to a small patch of wasteland that had recently caught her eye, not far from the cemetery in Ashireale. There, amid gorse bushes and wild fennel, she dug a small hole in the black volcanic soil, carefully laid the bundle in it, and weighed it down with a stone to prevent any dogs from digging it up. She improvised a small cross out of two sticks and some florist's wire, and stuck it in the cat's grave. She also attached a small note to the cross. It read, "Namaste to the unknown cat." And at that moment, like a big wave after a long ebb tide, everything came back to her. She recalled all that had happened on the night of the wedding, every last thing. She also realized only now that she had recognized the intruder on the roof by one tiny detail.
"Namaste, pussycat,"
Poldy said quietly.
"I'm going to get that swine. I most certainly am."
It was now clear that everything was connected. Everything had a deeper meaning. Perhaps the little tomcat had prevented her from getting drunk last night, so that she would find its corpse with a clear head and then recover her memory. This meant that she now owed it to the dead cat to solve the case, not just to Valentina. Now more than ever. The first thing Poldy did when she got home was re-examine her corkboard and go through her notes.
What did she know? Where had she got to? Who could be ruled out? She made another list. Unresolved. Red sand. Topographical map. Cash at Valentino's.
Knockout drops. Femina morta. Valerie's phone. Murder motive. Montana. Personal. Crossed out. Resolved. Tannenberger. Mr. X. Montana. Personal. A definite misunderstanding. Poldi felt in her handbag and found a paper napkin with a list of names. Rousseau, Patanay, Tannenberger, Valerie, Herdeline, crossed out, Mimi, Turi. One of them had called Valentino from Valerie's phone. All of them had been at the wedding party. One of them must have slipped the knockout drops into her wine. One of them had broken into her house and possibly killed the unknown cat as well. One of them had killed Valentino. But why? Poldi stepped back from her corkboard for a better overall view, but it wasn't enough, so she went up to the roof. To the sea, Etna, and the lion. And there she asked herself another question. Why had the intruder run such a risk for the sake of a stone lion that might earn him a mere 1,000 euros? The lion itself clearly disapproved of this question, because it promptly looked a trifle more dyspeptic, but Poldi was undeterred. The only explanation she could find was that the intruder must have been interested in something more than just the lion. In no time at all, Poldi had armed herself with a hammer and chisel, and was preparing to take up where the intruder had left off. It was a devil of a job. Valentino must have used the hardest cement in Italy. The sweat was trickling from under Poldi's wig after only a few hammer blows, but she persevered until she had chipped off the cement all round the base of the lion, and was able to detach it from the wall completely with a vigorous jerk. Panting hard, Poldi hefted the lion off the wall and onto the floor of the terrace. Clunk, clunk, clunk. Something went rolling across the floor. A small metal capsule that had been lodged in a recess in the base of the stone gatekeeper. An old, egg-shaped tea infuser, composed of two halves screwed together. Inside was a closely written inventory with prices listed in date order. In short, the murder motive. "The winner takes it all," I said when Poldi told me all this.
"As I told you," she said. At that moment I also recalled what Tannenberger had said in Munich, that Valentino had found something someone would pay him a lot of money to keep quiet about. I naturally realized that that something could only be this list.
"And who was Valentino putting the squeeze on?"
"My, aren't you impatient? One thing at a time."
Poldi did, of course, have a definite suspicion, but she had to prove it before she could rub Montana's nose in it, and in order to do that, she first had to stir up a lot of dust. Red dust. But one thing at a time. First came some arithmetic. Poldi added up the individual sums on the list and arrived at a total of over 2 million euros. The most expensive item was a complete 17th-century fresco for 500,000. There couldn't have been a better motive for murder. Still taking one thing at a time, Poldi found that the last item on the list was dated more than a year earlier. She compared that date with the newspaper reports of thefts from old country houses and found a match. The first report of such a theft was dated one day later. The subsequent dates also predated similar newspaper reports by a day or two. Poldi said, "Bingo," kissed her corkboard, and blessed Uncle Martino for his thorough research work. Uncle Martino had Swiss ancestors, and that leaves its genetic mark on a person. Swissness, combined with Oriental generosity and Sicilian crisis management, produces psychological metal of the very finest quality. Poldi made it her next step to check off all the listed dates on a calendar, and was surprised to find that every one of them had fallen on a Saturday.
And what does that tell us?
She asked me later. No idea.
Think. Why Saturday, do you reckon?
Go on, tell me.
A little tip. Because Sunday is the Lord's Day, and one can have a good lie-in.
What's the connection between that and theft?
Why, nothing as a rule. Not unless the thief has a strenuous full-time job and needs to recuperate if he spends the whole night stealing from country houses.
That's pretty far-fetched, I ventured to object.
But I'd recognize the intruder, don't forget, so I was bound to put two and two together.
At that point in her investigations, Poldy had a flash of inspiration.
She was in the zone.
It was pure intuition. She had simply seen the full picture. Going to the phone, she called Valerie.
Just a quick question, my dear. I need an address from you.
That evening, she rang the doorbell of a small house, situated on a bend in the Provinciale, just before Riposto. Not the best of locations, it must be said, and the house itself was a little old cottage with peeling walls. Behind it, however, Poldy made out an almond orchard, and no one who owns a cottage and an almond orchard is a total pauper. The windows of the little house were tightly shuttered in the usual Sicilian way, and no sounds were coming from inside. It wasn't until she had rung the bell a second time that Poldy heard a suspicious voice.
"Who is it?"
"Donna Poldina."
Poldy heard shuffling footsteps and coughing. Then the door opened a crack, and a face filled with suspicion and apprehension peered out of the frowsty interior.
"What do you want?"
"Good evening, Turi. I think we need to talk."
The old agricultural labourer peered around mistrustfully.
"I'm on my own, Turi, and that's the way it'll stay if you let me in."
"I can't think what you want from me, Donna Poldina."
Poldy said nothing. Turi hesitated for a moment, then sighed and let her in. The house was gloomy and stuffy. The heat of the day still lingered in its interior, which was redolent of sweat, old age and solitude. Two well-fed cats were romping around on the worn old sofa in the living room, which also contained a shabby carpet and a flat-screen television. The whole house shook as a lorry thundered past outside.
"Let's go into the orchard," said Turi. "It's quieter out there. Would you like some iced tea?"
"Please,"
said Poldy. The old man was limping, she saw.
"How's the leg?"
Turi turned and gave her a sorrowful look.
"Oh, Donna Poldina, you almost shot me like a mad dog."
Poldy nodded.
"You shouldn't have jumped over the wall like that."
"But you fired at me."
"I didn't. I just shouted bang."
"You shouted what?"
"Bang."
"You didn't fire?"
"Certainly not."
"But I heard the bullet whiz past me."
"Pure imagination. My old musket can't fire."
Turi shook his head in bewilderment.
"I'm getting too old for these things."
"How old are you, Turi?"
72.
"You really ought to retire."
"How can I, Donna Poldina? I can't survive on my pension alone."
Having rinsed two glasses, he took an old mineral water bottle full of amber-coloured iced tea from the refrigerator and filled them.
"Would you care for some lemon ice in it?"
"Yes, please."
Taking a spoon, Turi scooped some water ice from a plastic mug, carefully stirred it into the golden liquid, and then led the way out into the orchard. The 40-odd almond trees arrayed there in neat rows were heavy with furry green capsules. Turi had planted a vegetable garden along the wall and installed a plastic table and two chairs nearby. In the background, the traffic on the main road roared past like an unpleasant but inextinguishable memory, though the orchard itself made a quiet, peaceful impression. The two cats, which had followed Turi and Poldy outside, were aimlessly roaming around and mewing. Turi coaxed them over by clicking his tongue. They played coy at first, but then the fatter of the two leapt onto his lap and consented to be stroked. The other did the honours with Poldy.
"Nice orchard," said Poldy.
"A lot of work."
Poldy stroked the cat, sipped her iced tea,
which tasted both sweet and bitter, and waited.
"How did you recognize me?" asked Turi.
"When you raised your hands on the roof, one finger of your left-hand glove hung limp."
Turi held up his left hand, the one with a little finger missing.
"Madonna, you mean to say you noticed that in the dark?"
"To be honest, it only occurred to me this morning."
Poldi's cat had evidently had enough. It leapt off her lap and retired into the shade of an almond tree, leaving a warm patch of white hairs on her skirt. My aunt stroked the cat hairs into a little ball with her fingers.
"Somebody left a dead cat outside my front door this morning, with its throat cut."
"Madonna!"
Turi exclaimed in dismay.
"Surely you don't think I—"
"No. Not now. Any idea who it could have been?"
He slowly shook his head, which might have meant either that he really didn't know, or that he didn't want to say.
"May he roast in hell."
"He will."
"I didn't kill Valentino."
"So who did?"
"If I knew that, I'd have gone to the police a long time ago, believe me. Valentino was a good lad."
"And there's no one you suspect?"
Turi shook his head again, this time decisively. He stared at his almond trees in silence.
"Who was Valentino blackmailing?"
asked Poldi.
"Russo or Paternay?"
"I don't know, Donna Poldina. I had an idea Valentino was in some kind of trouble, but he never spoke to me about it."
"Then why did you call him from Valerie's phone the night before his death?"
"What? I didn't. Why should I use Signorina Belfiore's telephone, anyway? I've a mobile phone of my own. Besides, everyone knows that phone is rubbish."
Poldi thought for a moment.
"We're getting nowhere, Turi."
The old man stroked his cat.
"Are you going to the police, then?"
A difficult question. Poldi sighed. It was such a nice evening, too. The moon was rising above the almond trees, greeted by countless cicadas.
"You know the joke about God making Sicily out of bits of clay left over from the five continents?"
asked Poldi.
"The one where he creates the Sicilians to even things up?"
"That's the one."
Turi nodded.
"Great joke. Why?"
Poldi shrugged her shoulders.
"I suddenly remembered it, that's all. You're still a thief and a burglar, Turi."
"I'm really sorry I broke in. I shouldn't have got involved, but I'm no thief."
"No? What about all those country houses?"
"But, Donna Poldina, those weren't robberies."
And he proceeded to explain. When Poldi got home late that evening with a basket of ripe tomatoes and a big lump of pasta di mandorle, she was in high spirits. The first thing she did was strike Turi off her list of suspects, which now read, Russo, Paternay, Tannenberger, Valerie, Herdeline, crossed out, Mimi, Turi, crossed out. Only five names left, and one of those she could really have struck off after listening to Turi's account, but she was reluctant to be over hasty. One thing at a time. She didn't want to call Montana either, for one thing because of the Lido episode, but also because she had given Turi her word. Besides, one important piece of the puzzle was still missing, the scene of the crime. But Poldi was a step closer to that as well. Despite the lateness of the hour, she called Aunt Teresa.
"Has something happened?"
Teresa demanded, instantly on the alert.
"Don't worry, I'm absolutely fine. Have you been drinking?" "No, I'm stone-cold sober. Listen, I need your help, or rather Martino's. Could the two of you drop in here early tomorrow morning?"
Teresa's suspicions were promptly aroused, of course.
"What's it about?"
"Why?"
said Poldi, with lamb-like innocence.
"The case, of course."
A brief silence.
"I thought you intended to drop it."
"I did. But there's just been an important development. It's like a stalled car. If we give it a little push, it may start. Then the case will be solved."
Teresa re-injected some steel into her voice.
"Tell all that to Montana. You're off the case, Poldi."
You've no idea how utterly depressed I'm feeling.
My Auntie Poldy was adept at subtle hints, disguised threats and delicate allusions.
Is that a threat, Poldy?
No, it's just that I'm so emotionally unstable.
Teresa emitted a grunt of disapproval.
What sort of help?
Just local knowledge, that's all. We might go on a little trip.
A trip?
Not far, please, Teresa.
Poldy heard her sister-in-law say something unintelligible to Martino, the only word she distinguished being amore. Soon afterwards she heard Totti bark and knew it was a done deal. Martino, Teresa, and Totti appeared on the doorstep on the stroke of 9 the next morning. Poldy, who was again wearing her khaki linen outfit with the uniform jacket, had everything ready. On the table in the courtyard was a pitcher of ice-cold almond milk made with Turi's pasta di mandorle, and beside it the photo of the topographical map, the rolled-up strip of paper from the lion, and a map of Sicily with the thefts of recent months marked on it. Poldy was trembling with excitement. So was Totti, and Martino was only just controlling himself. Aunt Teresa alone remained entirely cool, because Poldy's little attempt at blackmail still rankled with her. She calmly sampled the almond milk.
"Excellent. How did you make it?"
"With my informant's pasta di mandorle."
Teresa ignored the keyword.
"It's really excellent."
Poldy got the message.
"Please forgive me, Teresa. The bit about being depressed just slipped out."
Teresa put her glass down.
"So who is this informant?"
When describing this scene to me in September, my Auntie Poldy broke off to interpolate a little footnote.
"The thing is," she said, "all your aunts are Taurians, which means they never bear a grudge. They're the opposite of Scorpios, and I know what I'm talking about. Make one mistake with a Scorpio, drop one little clanger, and you'll be on their blacklist for the rest of your days. Sooner or later, when you've forgotten all about it long ago, ouch, they sting you."
"Who was the Scorpio in this case?" I asked.
"Oh, well, that would be going too far.
I mean, did that play a role in your investigations?" Poldy looked at me as if I'd just discovered the formula for world peace. Without another word, she disappeared into her bedroom, rummaged in the cardboard box containing her investigative notes, and eventually turned up what she was looking for.
"Hallelujah!"
I heard her cry.
"Now I'll believe anything."
"So who was the Scorpio?"
I asked when she returned. Instead of replying, she showed me a slip of paper.
"All three!"
I exclaimed in bewilderment.
"You bet. And one of them is Valentino's murderer."
But back to that morning in the courtyard. Poldy kept quiet about the identity of her informant, as she had promised. With due brevity, she gave an account of recent developments, including the dead cat, the restoration of her memory, and the discovery of the antiquities price list.
"My informant confessed that he took part in the thefts with Valentino, but they weren't real thefts because they all took place with the tacit approval of the owner of the houses, who naturally took his cut."
"Why on earth should he do such a thing?"
"Because he's broke."
"Then he could simply have sold the houses."
"Yes, but only with the land that goes with them, and that's what the gentleman wanted to hang on to."
"Who?"
demanded Teresa.
"Mini Pastorella di Belfiore, of course. All the looted houses belong to him. That's to say, the ownership of some of the properties is unclear. He may not have wished to go shares with his relations."
"Then it remains theft,"
said Teresa.
"In principle, yes,"
Poldy conceded.
"Valentino used that to blackmail Paternay, too."
"Are you sure?"
"It's obvious."
"Paternay is Valentino's murderer, you mean?"
Uncle Martino chimed in.
"I'm convinced of it. Paternay compelled my informant to break in and steal the lion. That's why it was probably him that slipped the knockout drops into my wine, the same as he did with Valentino. So he's the murderer. I'm sure it was also him that left the dead cat outside my door."
"You must speak to Montana at once, then."
Poldy shook her head.
I must prove it first. And for that, we must find the scene of the crime.
We?
Yes. The thing is, Valentino told me before his death that he had something important to do at Femmina Morta. So I assumed that Valerie had something to do with it, because of the lion and Russo and so on. But yesterday my informant hinted that this wasn't necessarily so. Because, brace yourselves, there isn't just one Femmina Morta in Sicily. There's a whole bunch of them.
Teresa and Martino exchanged a look. Poldi was momentarily speechless.
You knew that?
Of course, Teresa said with a shrug.
In Italy, Femmina Morta is a far from uncommon name for small villages, just like Donna Fugata.
Or Donna Dolce, Martino amplified. Or Occhiobello, Campo di Miele, Buonvicino, Fiumilate, Bastardo, even Baciculo. They're all over the place.
Especially in the south, where people think more floridly and express themselves more bluntly. Poldi should really have thought of that, because place names such as Lovely Eye, Honeyfield, Good Neighbor, Milk River, Bastard, or Kiss Ass have similar counterparts in Bavaria. Many place names are colored by stories and personal destinies dating from times gone by, and many personal destinies repeat themselves in one way or another. At Valerie's Femmina Morta, near Riposto, a consumptive signorina whom everyone loved was said to have died during the 18th century. In another Femmina Morta, the dead female might have been murdered by a spurned admirer. At all events, the name was popular and catchy. Uncle Martino estimated that there were at least half a dozen Femmina Mortas in Sicily alone. Poldi couldn't take it in.
But for God's sake, why did you never say anything?
Embarrassed shoulder shrugging.
You never asked.
That was true, too. Pragmatism was the only answer. My Auntie Poldi had never been one to fret for long over mistakes, faux pas, or missed opportunities, because she knew a thing or two about coming unstuck, tripping up, making a fool of yourself and getting a bloody nose, just as she also did about starting afresh, picking yourself up, laughing at yourself, and standing for no nonsense. I sometimes think that her only blind spot is not letting go. She briefly vented her feelings with a characteristic obscenity, then spread out her map of Sicily on the table.
All right, Martino. Where are all these Femmina Mortas?
Uncle Martino vaguely tapped various places in the east and centre of the island.
Can't you be more precise?
He scratched his head uneasily.
It's been a while.
Amore,
Aunt Teresa said sternly.
Concentrate. Don't let us down.
Us. Poldi beamed. Half a packet of MS later, Uncle Martino had made 5 red squiggles on the map. They were scattered all over the island and well away from towns.
Is that the lot?
He raised his hands defensively.
There are as many as I can remember, and as I say, they're unofficial place names. Landed estates, small villages, sometimes just an old bridge described as such by the local peasants.
Poldi eyed the map morosely.
They're far too scattered for us to visit them all.
She firmly drew a line through 2 red squiggles in the north and south of the island.
Too far away.
Teresa and Martino said nothing. Poldi compared the remaining sites with the photo she had taken in Taormina of the topographical map in Russo's transparent folder. The details did not correspond, but she tried, nonetheless, turning the map this way and that. Unable to find a match, she angrily thrust it aside.
Hell and damnation!
Beh.
Uncle Martino stubbed out his cigarette and looked at his watch.
Nearly midday. I'll just nip over to the fish market in Riposto.
You're staying here. I won't be a moment.
Uncle Martino and Aunt Teresa looked at each other. Teresa almost imperceptibly shook her head, probably hoping that the situation would resolve itself and that Poldi's addiction to the thrill of the chase would gradually subside.
No such luck.
Poldi fetched her father's magnifying glass from the chest of drawers in the living room and used it to study the 3 remaining squiggles. She traced roads with her finger, deciphered place names, discovered churches, monasteries, archaeological sites and ruins, estimated distances, sighed, muttered to herself, and denied herself a beer. At the edge of a squiggle which Martino had made near Piazza Armerina, near Enna, and almost obliterated by red ink, she eventually made out a cartographic symbol, an inverted miner's kit consisting of two crossed hammers.
What does that mean?
An abandoned mine. Poldi considered this. An idea took shape in her mind. Only a crumb of an idea, it detached itself from the depths of her subconscious and headed for the surface. Sluggishly borne upwards by the magma of molten memories, it got stuck halfway and made no further progress.
What sort of mine?
Uncle Martino glanced at the map.
An old sulphur mine, I should think.
Poldi could almost hear the pop as the little plug of an idea came adrift, shot into her consciousness, and crystallized there. Jumping up, she dashed to the corkboard in her bedroom and returned with the photograph she'd taken in Valentino's room of his little collection of minerals. She tapped the yellow crystal at the edge of the print.
Could something like that be found there?
Uncle Martino put on his reading glasses.
Well, certainly. Sicilian sulphur mines contain the finest sulphur crystals in the world.
Poldi triumphantly folded up the map.
Let's go, then.
Chapter 13 Tells of Sulphur, Kisses, and Unresolved Trivialities, and of what Poldi found at Femina Morta with the aid of radar beam technology. What matters is finding something, not looking for it. And who knows that better than Inspector Chance?
Totti tries to look good and succeeds brilliantly, but so does Montana.
There is coffee and marzipan, good and bad news, and an unexpected visitor.
The history of sulphur mining in Sicily is a ballad of superabundance and wealth, greed and suffering,
Uncle Martino told me once.
Sicilian sulphur formed on the Messinian Plateau, when, over 5 million years ago, the waters of the Mediterranean evaporated and left behind vast deposits of sulphurous gypsum. The Greeks and Romans, who already knew of these immense deposits, extracted the yellow element from numerous mines near Agrigento and in the Enna-Sciacca-Gela Triangle. Miners burrowed into the local mountains for many centuries, perforating their interiors like a sponge. The mountain sides are covered with heaps of spoil, and among them are the primitive, mounded furnaces in which sulphur was melted out and cast into rectangular slabs. In the 19th century came the boom. Budding industrialized countries needed sulfuric acid, and Sicily could supply it. The island was then the world's leading supplier of sulphur, with a market share of 80%, which gave it a near monopoly in sulphur production. But working conditions in the mines were murderous. The miners, who worked naked because of the heat underground, seared their lungs with sulphur dust and the poisonous fumes given off by melting and roasting sulphur ore. Thousands of children, the so-called carusi, had to tote sacks and baskets filled with iron pyrites up the steep shafts that led from the mines to the furnaces, for 12 hours at a time, day after day. Few of them even reached puberty. Tens of thousands of miners perished, either underground or from tending the furnaces or from starvation in their homes. The poverty must have been unimaginable, for the mine owners, who belonged to the Bourbon nobility and were becoming ever wealthier thanks to their monopoly, paid starvation wages and had absolutely no concern for their miners. Blinded by their monopoly position and inexhaustible deposits, they saw no reason to improve working conditions or invest in new technologies. On the contrary, greed impelled them simply to carry on regardless, the Sicilian disease, as Uncle Martino always calls it, until the boom abruptly came to an end. Why? Because the Americans soon invented a cheaper process for extracting sulphur, large quantities of which were obtained as a byproduct of petroleum processing. By early in the 20th century, one mine was closing after another,
and today there is not a single active sulphur mine left in the whole of Sicily. I picture Uncle Martino telling Poldi all this on the drive to the sulphur mine near Piazza Armerina. I picture Aunt Teresa sitting in the passenger seat, cheerful and rather excited, behaving as if she had heard it all 100 times before, which she undoubtedly had. However, I'm sure her face glowed with pride at her husband's encyclopedic knowledge of Sicily, any little gaps in which he liberally and imaginatively papered over. I picture Poldi sitting in the back with Dotty's heavy head on her lap, stroking it thoughtfully and filled with dark forebodings. Beyond Catania, Uncle Martino turned off onto the A19, direction Palermo, a motorway that runs straight through the heart of Sicily, past hills mantled with wheatfields and sun-baked relics of antiquity, past ruined bridges leading nowhere and illegal rubbish dumps, across expanses of desert and through magical variations in light. Midway between Catania and Palermo lies Enna. Visible from a long way off, the city is situated high up on a plateau, and the outlying buildings break off flush with its edge, almost as if they had sprouted from the mountain itself, like an impure material, thought Poldi, who of course knew that Enna was still regarded as a stronghold of the Mafia. But they weren't bound for Enna. Uncle Martino left the motorway and turned off south in the direction of Armerina, which is noted for its late Roman luxury villa with a wonderful mosaic floor, depicting, among other things, 10 girls wearing a kind of bikini. But they didn't want to visit the bikini-clad girls. They were bound for Femina Morta. The abandoned mine lay a good mile outside the town, beyond a small hill and pine woods. Access was barred by a rusty metal pole with a prohibitive notice attached to it, so they had to leave the car. Totti, who enjoyed long road trips with Uncle Martino as little as I did, leapt out in relief and disappeared into the woods. A rutted sandy track led through the trees. The air smelt of resin and herbs and sulphur. Beyond the wood, a steep slope strewn with spoil led down to the mining site. Poldi made out the ruins of a pithead frame, dilapidated buildings with dry stone walls, the collapsed round-arched entrances to the mine shafts in the hillside opposite, and the old grass and gorse-covered smelting furnaces, which reminded her of prehistoric barrows. Everything was covered with a film of dust, dirt, and oxidized sulphur compounds. The sand had a reddish tinge in places, Poldi noticed. She could still smell sulphur. Sharp and evil-smelling, it stung her nose, irritated the mucous membranes, and seemed to shout a warning to her to be gone. This wasn't what Poldi had expected. She could see no sign anywhere of a country mansion, or even of an ordinary house. Valerie's Femina Morta was a miniature paradise, whereas this one was the forecourt to hell, or had been in the past.
"What an eerie place," Aunt Teresa said uneasily.
"And so utterly remote," said Poldi. "You can't hear a thing. No traffic, not even a bird. Would you two prefer to wait in the car?"
"Are you crazy?"
Uncle Martino lit another cigarette, as if this were one of his usual sightseeing trips, and led the way down a winding track just wide enough for a single vehicle. Poldi noticed that Totti, who had reappeared, was staying close beside him. The dog seemed to feel that nothing good could come of this excursion. Neither wagging his tail nor barking with excitement and the spirit of adventure as he usually did, he looked as if he would have preferred to be invisible. He kept sneezing, and Poldi did likewise. It occurred to her that the stench of sulphur was the best protection against uninvited visitors, but there could be no question of turning back.
"So, where is Femina Morta?"
she called to Martino.
"This is Femina Morta," he called back over his shoulder. "It's the name of the mine."
"Oh, so you've suddenly remembered that, have you?"
Martino tapped his forehead.
"It's all in there, all filed away. It sometimes takes a while, but everything comes back to me sooner or later. I was shown this mine by the branch manager of the local Banco di Sicilia, who had got out of a tricky situation with my help. Must be over 20 years ago. He planned to convert it into a sort of sports center for young people, but the owner squelched the idea.
Who was the owner?
A certain Count Pastorella di Belfiore.
Poldi wasn't even surprised. Having reached the mining site, she looked around. It formed an elongated L, flanked by wooded hills and mounds of spoil covered with scrub. Invisible from outside, it was a place without shadows. Dazzlingly bright in the afternoon light, a dead, forgotten place that seemed to have been carved out of the world. The air was fraught with heat, dust, and the memory of multitudinous suffering. Sweating from every pore, Poldi pictured what life must have been like for the miners and the Carusi. She half expected the ghosts of the dead children to come shuffling out of the mine shafts at any moment.
"What are we looking for?"
asked Teresa, who was clearly feeling ill at ease. Poldi hadn't the faintest idea.
"I'm not looking, I'm finding," she declared,
and strode boldly off through the dust and the smell of sulphur.
"That's what Picasso said,"
she explained to me in September.
"That's the way he worked. Simply take the plunge and see where you end up. You might bear that in mind for that novel of yours. You've got to find, not look. Stay open, be receptive, be ready for anything. Know what I mean? Take things as they come. Make hay while the sun shines."
"Thanks, I get the picture," I broke in rather irritably.
"Perhaps you'd also explain how it works, this finding business?"
"Of course I will. It's dead easy. Even you could master it with a bit of practice."
The prime essential was a roving eye. Like a bushman in the Kalahari, Poldi swept the site with her gaze, back and forth, to and fro, because concentrating too hard on individual objects blinds one to the rest. Hunters, mushroom pickers, professional photographers and tour guides all know this. Poldi's gaze traversed the site like a radar beam. One step forward, radar beam. One step sideways, radar beam. Teresa and Martino did likewise, step by step, cautiously, like skaters on thin ice. It was an evil place. That was beyond doubt. Not even animals wanted to live there, it seemed. Not a bird to be heard. Nothing rustling in the gorse bushes that had conquered the whole area despite the contaminated soil. Perhaps, thought Poldi, because yellow plants fare better in sulphur dust. She strove to concentrate, in spite of her mounting uneasiness and an almost overwhelming urge to quit the place as fast as possible. She saw ruins, rusty machine parts and weather-worn refuse on the hillside, together with a covered cistern and, in front of it, some brightly coloured plastic toys. Two cars had evidently driven in and out of here since it last rained, or within the last 2 months, one with wide tyres with coarse treads and the other with narrower ones. There were footprints everywhere too, but Poldi couldn't detect how many people had been walking around here. Not that all of this meant anything, because the site appeared to be unguarded. Anyone could come here, but the longer Poldi surveyed the place, the more certain she became that no one visited it willingly. No wonder the sports centre had come to nothing, she reflected. Her thoughts strayed. They yielded to the urge to flee before her legs did, but her legs followed suit, surreptitiously retreating. When she noticed this, when she sternly called herself to order and refocused her radar beam on the ground, she spotted the little fragment of pottery. It was lying beneath a gorse bush, and might have continued to lie there for all eternity. One small, blue, insignificant particle in the infinity of all things. But Inspector Chance had evidently just come on duty, conducted a brief review of the progress of the investigation, cleared his throat, said a few words, and then withdrawn from the proceedings to get himself a coffee. Poldi did not make the mistake of picking up the potsherd or even touching it. She had instantly recognized its blue glaze, which glinted at her in the afternoon light. She merely took a photograph of it and made a note of the spot.
"Valentino was here?"
she called to Teresa and Martino.
"Why, have you found something?" "A piece of glazed pottery. It probably fell out of his pocket,"
so we'll call the police, right?
Aunt Teresa couldn't wait to leave the place.
No, we aren't finished yet.
Poldy was quite sure now. Absolutely no urge to flee now, on the contrary. She whistled through her fingers for Totti, whose nose she now needed.
You can whistle through your fingers, I broke in, when she told me this weeks later. Of course. Can't you?
Show me.
My, how suspicious you are,
she sighed. Sticking her thumb and forefinger between her teeth, she produced a whistle that nearly punctured my eardrums.
Convinced? May I go on, or are you tired or bored or something?
Forza, Poldy, I told her. Totti pricked his ears and came scampering up, obviously relieved that they didn't intend to abandon him there. He had something in his mouth which he proudly presented to Poldy. A dog's toy in soft yellow plastic, rather chewed and the worse for wear.
Ugh! What have you got there?
Poldy exclaimed, trying to relieve Totti of his find.
No, drop it! It's Mackie!
Totti reluctantly released his treasure and wagged his tail, preparing to retrieve it at once if the nice lady with a deep voice would please, please consent to throw it for him. But she didn't. She tossed it carelessly aside and held him back by the collar when he tried to dash after it.
Be a good dog.
Look, my pet, I know it's asking a lot of you, but you've got to concentrate, you hear?
My aunt dragged the unhappy and bewildered Totti to the spot where the potsherd was lying and gently applied his nose to the ground.
There. Smell anything? Can you smell Valentino? Go on, sniff.
Totti squinted at his treasure one last time, then gave up and dutifully sniffed the ground around the gorse bush, periodically sneezing. When Poldy was kind enough to release him at last, he stared up at her uncertainly for a moment.
Well, go on. Seek.
Poldy wasn't very hopeful. Suspecting that Totti had specialized too exclusively in Etna mushrooms, she was doubly gratified when he eventually trotted off and sniffed the ground here and there, giving at least the impression that he was a tracker who knew what he was doing. In the knowledge that artists and detectives must not be disturbed at their work, Poldy and Uncle Martino followed Totti at an appropriate distance, urging him on with cries of encouragement. Aunt Teresa, by contrast, had sat down in the shade of the pithead frame and was hoping that they would all be able to leave this sinister place before long. Despite his professional manner, Totti seemed to find it hard to pick up Valentino's scent anywhere. The longer she criss-crossed the site in Totti's wake, the more convinced Poldy became that this had been a thoroughly daft idea. She looked over at Aunt Teresa, who raised a limp hand in her direction, and took out her mobile phone.
That's it. I'm going to call Montana. Not even the best-trained sleuth-hound could find anything in this stench.
But Totti, who was steadfastly continuing to sniff away, had begun to scrabble at the base of the old system.
What's he doing?
Uncle Martino shrugged.
Improving his bella figura. He's a Sicilian, after all.
Poldy whistled through her fingers again.
Leave it, Totti. Knocking off time.
But Totti went on scrabbling at the system. He barked, looked over at Poldy and Martino, and barked again, loudly. Aunt Teresa got to her feet and emerged from the shade. Poldy looked at Martino.
What does that mean?
Sounds like mushrooms.
Poldy hurried over. Totti, beside himself by now, was scrabbling at the system like a mad thing and barking excitedly. The circular coping, composed of rough-hewn stone that had once been rendered, came up to Poldy's waist. The mouth of the old reservoir was sealed with a rusty iron plate secured with a padlock. Poldy made out some reddish-brown splashes on the iron plate, and a part of the surround Totti was scratching. A lot of splashes. She didn't need a lab report, to be sure. She kissed and patted Totti and called Montana.
Vito, it's me. Can you come to Piazza Armerina? I've got something for you.
The scene of the crime. It was evening by the time Montana got there. Streaky red clouds were glowing in the sky like a monstrous projection of Valentino's blood spatter. Possibly a warning from higher authority that his death would not be forgotten or unavenged, thought Poldy.
Namaste, Sirostratus. The Polizia di Stato had already cordoned off the area around the cistern. Forensics officers in paper overalls were busying themselves with their brushes and sticky tape, scratching off blood samples, taking photographs while the light lasted, making plaster casts of the tire tracks, and sticking little flags in the ground. Poldi and Aunt Teresa were watching in silence from the sidelines when Uncle Martino returned from the town with panini and mineral water. They also ate in silence, depressed by their discovery, the mine, their own impotence, and the sight of the policeman's dispassionate professionalism. Only Totti looked cheerful and interested in everything, as if he'd just been dunked in a fountain of youth.
"Why don't you go home?" Poldi suggested. "I'm sure Montana will give me a lift."
"Out of the question," said Aunt Teresa.
When Montana arrived, in his crumpled work suit as usual, Poldi rose, straightened her wig, and patted the dust from her linen trousers.
"Salve."
Montana greeted Teresa and Martino with a handshake, Poldi with two perfunctory kisses on the cheek.
"Hello, Vito."
Montana surveyed his surroundings.
"So this is the place."
Poldi said nothing.
"How did you hit on it, Poldi?"
"I put two and two together, that's all."
"Can you be more precise?"
"Valentino mentioned Femina Morta, you remember?"
"And?"
She spread out her arms in the direction of the mine.
"Femina Morta?"
"There are two of them."
"At least six," Uncle Martino put in. Montana groaned.
"Madonna, what an idiot I am."
"Don't blame yourself. I didn't hit on it by myself either."
"But why this particular one?"
Poldi handed him the photograph of Valentina's collection of bits and pieces and pointed out the sulfur crystal.
"Crystal? Sulfur? Mine? Femina Morta? That's the name of the mine. It was worth a try."
She felt in her bag and handed him the tea infuser containing Valentina's price list.
"I found that in the Lion yesterday. It proves that Paternay is behind the thefts."
Montana opened the infuser and glanced at the strip of paper, then rolled it up again and put it in an evidence bag together with the infuser. Poldi was expecting a reprimand for having failed to report the discovery earlier, but Montana merely looked over at the policeman around the murder site.
"Anything else I should know?"
Poldi shook her head.
"Okay, I'll be back with you in a minute."
Montana sauntered over to the uniformed inspector in charge of the operation. Poldi saw Montana show his ID, saw him receive a brief rundown from the inspector, and accompany him over to the murder site, unhurriedly, with the professional arrogance and composure she found more and more exasperating.
"Let's go," she said to Teresa and Martino. "We aren't needed here any more."
It almost broke Dotti's heart to leave the scene of his criminalistic triumph in such an unobtrusive, unacknowledged way. He had to be dragged off.
"Poldi?"
Montana beckoned her over to the cistern. Sullenly and reluctantly, Poldi returned to the spot where Valentino had died.
"Well?"
"What's that?" asked Montana.
"An old cistern, I guess."
"I meant that."
Montana pointed to the rusty iron lid.
"A cover to protect anyone from falling in."
"Have you looked at the padlock?"
The sun had disappeared behind the hill long ago, flooding the mine with shadows and effacing all the light and colour from the dip in which it lay. Poldi had to bend down to see what Montana meant.
"It looks new."
"Brand new, I'd say. A brand new padlock on an old iron lid."
Poldi stared at him. Montana turned to the inspector.
"I need some bolt cutters right away."
Not long afterwards, when Montana lifted the iron lid, a smell of decay assailed them from the dark interior of the old reservoir. Montana shone a flashlight into it. Poldi could see little at first. An oblong, cement-lined water tank of indeterminate dimensions, the cistern was a good 10 feet deep. It no longer contained any water,
and the bottom was covered with dust and soil. The beam of the flashlight flitted to and fro until Poldy spotted something that looked like a bundle of clothes. Rotting, colourless articles of clothing, they were also covered in dust. When the beam came to rest on them, Poldy detected something else.
"Oh, my God! Is that..."
"Looks like it," Montana said harshly.
Wrapped in those dusty articles of clothing on the bottom of the dried-up reservoir was a human skeleton. Poldy heard nothing from Montana for the next 2 days. Then she'd had enough. Sleep was out of the question in any case, because the air above Torre Akirafi had been rent every half-hour from early in the morning onwards by monstrous whiz-bangs fired from the nearby church square, so as to explode, boom, just above the rooftops. Poldy was no stranger to this sort of thing. It was doubtless some local patron saint's name day, which had to be duly celebrated, boom, all day long. That evening there would probably be a concluding firework display and a little street festival in the church square. Until then, boom! These half-hourly salutes would make the walls shake and make Poldy's ears ring, so a quick exit from town was called for. Poldy drove to Ashiriali, parked the Alfa in a no-stopping zone on the Corso Umberto, and strode resolutely towards the gloomy, neo-baroque building that housed police headquarters. Dapper policemen wearing shades and nursing coffees to go were lounging in front of the courtyard entrance, as though recreating a scene outside precinct headquarters in Manhattan South. Confronted by this image of state police and carabinieri united in nonchalant self-importance, Poldy resisted the impulse to take a photo and strode past the uniformed youngsters without a word. It was pleasantly cool in the prefecture's inner courtyard. Populated by dolphins and nymphs and surrounded by parked patrol cars, a marble fountain sang its sibilant song of hidden beauty. A small orange tree stood to attention in each corner of the courtyard, and the scent of the jasmine on the walls competed with the stench of exhaust fumes. Poldy had seen numerous police stations and headquarters in her time, but never one like this. The prefecture of Ashiriali was one big apology in itself. Seated in a glassed-in box at the entrance was a pallid young desk sergeant with sorrowful eyes and an outsize Adam's apple gracing his scrawny neck.
"Commissario Montana," said Poldy.
"Do you have an appointment, signora?"
"No, I don't, but that doesn't matter. The commissario will see me."
A long look from those sorrowful eyes. Poldy saw the Adam's apple slide up and down as if sawing its way out of that far too slender neck.
"Name?"
"Oberreiter. Isolde."
She spelt out her surname.
"Otranto, Bologna, Empoli, Doppiaere, Empoli, Imola, Torino, Empoli, Roma. Oh, just tell him Poldy wants a word with him."
The pallid desk sergeant telephoned, covering his mouth and the mouthpiece with his hand.
"The commissario is coming right away."
"Don't bother. Just tell me where to find his office."
The Adam's apple danced a tarantella.
"Kindly wait here, signora."
Montana appeared a few minutes later. He was looking exhausted, with dark smudges under his eyes and a trifle nervous. There was a coffee stain on his suit. He nodded to the mournful desk sergeant, took Poldy by the arm, and led her to the exit. No kiss.
"Let's go and have a coffee. There's a bar around the corner."
"We could go to your office."
"No, Poldy, we can't."
"Because your pretty young colleague is there? Or because there are envelopes full of hush money lying around on your desk?"
"Very funny, Poldy. And she isn't my colleague."
"You're welcome to tell me some more about her."
Pursing his lips, Montana steered my Auntie Poldy gently but firmly past his colleagues and out of the gateway.
"I was going to call you this evening, in any case."
"Oh, yes?"
"Yes."
He looked stung. In the bar round the corner, he ordered two coffees and a marzipan mandarin, and shepherded Poldy to the far end of the counter.
"I've got good news and bad news. Which do you want first?"
"The good news, of course.
Well, the good news is you're still speaking to me.
Very funny. Poldy tried to look sour, but failed a bit.